Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View. I'm your always wonderful host, PK, and this is for Monday evening, October 31st. Happy Halloween, everyone. So, as always, I'd like to thank the guys at bbsradio.com for promoting free speech, free press, free communications, and their alternative media to get the word out to people who aren't locked into the corporate pro-Zionist, pro-corporate media. I have a friend coming back, and this is a pre-recorded show, everyone, so there'll be no call-ins. I have a friend coming back. He was here about 2 months ago. My friend Paul Hager is coming back. And when we last spoke, we talked about nuclear power. And as you know, I'm basically pro-nukes. I had some concerns about, mostly about how to handle the waste, which Paul said that was a good question. So Paul is he's a smart guy. He's sort of a scientist. He's an analyst with the Department of the Navy. He's a computer whiz. He has a sociology background. He's a very strong libertarian viewpoints. And today we're going to talk primarily about guns. You should know that your wonderful host here, PK, I'm very pro-gun. I'm a proud gun owner, as is my guest, Paul. But what's interesting about Paul's background is he grew up sort of in Texas in a gun environment, but then he sort of was anti-gun for a while or skeptical, and then he's sort of come full circle, and he's a very strong proponent of our Second Amendment rights, which, of course, are really property rights. So Paul is going to – we're going to talk about this today, and it should be a good conversation. And I'm also going to bring up about how the drug war ties into so many needless murders and misuses of our rights to own guns, if you will. So with that, Paul, are you out there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Hey, welcome back to Third Stream View, and happy Halloween.
Right.
Would you like some
– it is Halloween soon, isn't it?
Yes. Would you like some tea or coffee?
Neither, thank you.
Oh, okay, thank you. Well, listen, welcome back.
I got
chocolate
milk here, so.
Oh, that's good. As you know, this evening's discussion is about guns and gun ownership and gun rights and all those things. And as I mentioned briefly, that you grew up with in a gun environment in Texas. You were around guns. I think you were on a shooting team. And then you sort of morphed into an anti-gun sort of position. But then you've years ago, you've really come full circle. You're a staunch proponent of gun ownership and the Second Amendment. Is that sort of correct?
Yeah, that pretty well capsulizes my personal journey. If you want me to elaborate a little bit.
Sure, please. Elaborate on your sort of concisely and briefly your journey from, you know, teenager years.
Yeah, it's my positions are largely data driven, and so I was influenced by, I guess, all things liberal when I was in my teens. And being a sociology major, you're going to be steeped in a liberal left-wing environment. I would describe my sociology department as being about half of them were liberal and the other half were Marxist. So that should give you some idea of the attitudes that were around me. As you mentioned, I had been on the rifle team in high school. I was maybe a slightly better than average shooter. But absorbing all this information, it seemed as though guns were an atavistic remnant from the frontier days and were no longer necessary, and there was a significant social cost to holding on to this symbol of the frontier. And that was sort of my attitude. And over time, I guess from the time I was in college, I started college in 1968. I think maybe by sometime in the late 70s or thereabouts, I began to rethink my position through the 70s and into the early 80s. And some of it had to do with an argument that was rather common that, there's always concern among liberals that the government might become despotic, particularly if the Republicans are in charge. And, of course, libertarians are always concerned about that. And as I began to drift in a more libertarian direction, it still didn't seem as though guns would be of much use in resisting tyranny. But the experience of watching what happened in Vietnam and later Afghanistan indicated that low-tech insurgents could actually do a pretty good job mostly with small arms. And so I began to rethink my position there. Then along the way, I began to come across more research in the social sciences that indicated that, maybe guns are not so detrimental after all. And so by the time of the early 90s, which was around the time you and I met, you'll recall that I was very heavily into fighting drug prohibition.
Right.
As were you. And at that time, I was involved with the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, which is a branch of the ACLU.
Right.
And although I was heavily involved in the drug war, that was my main issue. I found myself getting in discussions on the internet, which was fairly new then, and I was getting in discussions on a group called Talk Politics Guns. I found that my views were being challenged quite effectively. I was primarily debating meaning of the Second Amendment and defending the ACLU position, which was it's sort of a reserved state power. I was being challenged on that. And so finally, I approached the then executive director of the Indiana Civil Liberties Union, who at the time was a sort of a libertarian-oriented Republican, but has since become a Democrat, and I've kind of lost track of him. But I said, this would be a good political thing for us to do, and that would be to do our own investigation of the Second Amendment, meaning the Second Amendment. And at the same time, and one of the things that sort of engendered this idea was that the then president of the National ACLU, whose name is currently eluding me, but a woman law professor had actually spoken at a libertarian convention, in 92. So she was the newly elected president of the ACLU. Nadine Strossen, that's her name.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, Nadine Strossen had actually spoke at the National Libertarian Convention and was asked about that, about the Second Amendment. You know, why does the ACLU have this anti Second Amendment position? She said, maybe we should revisit that. And so there was something going on at the national level. So I said, hey, we should do this. And it was my involvement in that, initially just as a suggestion, but I didn't want to run it because I was focused on drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But through a series of events, I found myself heading the commission. And because I was in charge of it, I was doing more and more research, and that came to overwhelm everything I was doing at the time. And over a period of about a year and a half, my position... I completed that 180 swing that had started, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s.
Wow, so
it took about It was a long process, but the really concentrated part of the change was from maybe mid 92 up to late 93 or thereabouts. About a year and a half period.
Okay, so was part of this was the I'm kind of. It's kind of my belief that the ACLU's position on guns at that time was, or maybe it still is that guns, yes, guns, the Second Amendment applies to police, the militia, you know, the military, law enforcement. Was that their sort of like reasoning on that largely?
Yeah, the ACLU position was that it was a quote, collective right, unquote. And it was really focused on that preamble clause, you know, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Right.
So the purpose clause just swallowed everything up, and the independent clause, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. That part was just that was an afterthought.
Right.
And the commission that I ended up chairing put together a report, and there was a piece I wrote, and I don't know, maybe you wrote it, maybe you read it in prep for this, but it's about the 14th Amendment, section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which is really key. For an organization like the ACLU, because it has to do with the application of the Bill of Rights to the states, and that would include the Second Amendment. So the ACLU, the big focus of the ACLU is really on the First Amendment, right?
Right.
That's... But what I did in this piece that I wrote about the 14th Amendment, which was called Instructive Tales. I think that was the title. Anyway, what I did in that piece was that I attacked the foundations of the ACLU position on the First Amendment, and in particular, the separation of church and state component. You know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise. You know, those,
right.
that section of the First Amendment. And so I put together a really strong attack, saying that's not incorporated. And then I said, the arguments in favor of the incorporation of the Second are much stronger. And I laid them out. And I pointed out that actually the Section 1 of the 14th was primarily pushed by Congressman John Bingham of Ohio, who Congress was preparing to pass civil rights legislation. And Bingham said... Yeah, you're right. We got to do this, but it's unconstitutional. Congress doesn't have any power, or at least if you're actually following the Constitution, something that we haven't done in at least a century. But Congress doesn't have the power to reach down to the states and impose from the central government impose civil rights, whatever those may be. The,
sure.
The Bill of Rights is applicable. It applies only to the federal government. So Bingham says, look, we need to pass an amendment that will give us the authority to do that. And the impetus behind the civil rights legislation and therefore the 14th Amendment was that in the Reconstruction era South, there were there were Republicans in the South, and there were all these freed slaves, and there were agents of the various former Confederate, now soon to enter the Union, state governments that were systematically going and disarming the freed slaves and disarming Republicans, and then armed mobs would come and maybe, you know, lynch the former slaves and terrorize and beat the Republicans. And, oh, by the way, if the Republicans happen to be running a newspaper, once again, they can't defend themselves because the officials have come, and under color of state law, they have disarmed the Republican newspaper owners, and then the mobs come and burn them out. So it was actually freedom of the press and the right to keep and bear arms that were the two primary reasons for the passage of the 14th Amendment. And so I hammered that. And I had a really good source, a liberal constitutional scholar by the name of Michael Kent Curtis, who wrote what I consider to be the authoritative book on the history and meaning of the 14th Amendment. And needless to say, my efforts came to naught. What happened was that the board, being confronted with extremely strong arguments, what they did was they voted to not argue. They voted to table any further consideration, and that was the end of it.
Wow.
Profoundly disillusioning experience. But anyway, I've kind of rattled on for a while, but I thought it was important to focus on that particular period when I went from being sort of indifferent, it was kind of an interesting intellectual exercise, to where I became heavily involved, heavily invested, and ultimately very disillusioned with the ACLU.
My main problem with the ACLU is that they, in my humble yet all-knowing opinion, they don't tend to respect the whole Bill of Rights. You know, their First Amendment is sacred to them, and the rest, well, they're the I get the feeling, well, they're the rest. I never got that feeling that they were really there for me for the complete Bill of Rights. And,
well, yeah. There is a hole in the Bill of Rights where the Second Amendment is. And the third is kind of interesting. The third tends not to apply all that much. We won't get into that. But the ACLU is good on the fourth. ACLU is pretty good on the fourth. It's fairly good on the fifth, but there is a little hole in the fifth on the takings clause. So
sure.
When it comes to property rights, well, the ACLU isn't so good on that. The ACLU just doesn't really care all that much about, you know, taking without just compensation. There's a hole there.
The whole
They're
Bill
good
of
on
Rights.
The sixth and the seventh and the eighth. Good on the ninth. Tenth does not exist. They're not.
Yeah, I know. But all the Bill of Rights are pretty much have a lot to do with property rights when it gets down to it. When you think about it, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. There is sort of implicit, if you will, the right of self ownership.
Now here's something I was curious about.
So that's certainly the ultimate property right.
Definitely. I know that you faced opposition and maybe some ridicule or back turning on you for your pro nuke position years ago. Did you did you experience any of that negativity towards your pro gun rights point of view? Did you get any of that vibing?
Well, I think I was held to be maybe a little crazy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, there's Hager going off on one of his crazy things again. But you know, I was my relations with the other board members were cordial afterwards. Though there were certain people who I didn't really trust anymore, and I felt as though they had they had demonstrated a complete lack of intellectual integrity.
Right.
So that changed things. I will say this. After the Heller and McDonald cases, the beauty of those cases is that they actually pretty much validated exactly what the board recommended. So those two cases, the first was the D.C. case, which was the Second Amendment, and the second case was the 14th Amendment, the incorporation case. And essentially, it was everything that we argued. It put it all together. So, it only took, 16 years for me to be vindicated? But it was pretty good.
Yeah, well, it's nice to know that when you're consistent and you're on the right track and that vindication comes along, it's too bad it doesn't come along sooner.
Look at it this way. Galileo had to wait 300 years before the Catholic Church said, hey, guess what? We're wrong. Of course, the ACLU hasn't admitted they're wrong, but they know they're wrong.
They're liberals.
Sadly, that's true. There was a core of people on the ICLU board who were more libertarian oriented. There are several Republicans.
That's good.
They basically sided with me. But we were a tiny, tiny minority.
Well, as far as gun ownership goes, of course. On the negative aspects or the critical aspects, the criticisms the gun crowd gets is, the violent crimes committed with guns, of course, and this and that. I would like to know, I'm sure this couldn't be mathematically done, even for a person like you with math and, scientific method. I don't think you could ever come up with an exact corollary, but I would be very curious to what the estimated corollary would be between this tragic, insane war on drugs and gun usage in an illegal, which brings out murder and killing, the aspects of gun ownership that we don't approve of unless it's self-defense or sport. How much of this pitiful drug war has caused all this extra gun violence that wouldn't normally exist, which, by the way, as you know, and I'm sure you agree, it makes it more difficult to defend gun ownership rights because of all this crime committed by what government caused in the first place.
Yeah. You've raised a very important point, and I think you probably alluded to it before, and I kind of glossed over it. My involvement in the drug war, in fighting against that, informed me about how this process. The process of accretion of power to the central government, and in particular to bureaucracies, to these unelected bureaucrats within the government, how that process of accretion goes on. And what I observed from my extensive research into how the drug war came about and how it was being fought was, gee, the same thing has been going on with guns. And I began to see the parallels. And there was another event that I didn't mention, but you and I have talked about it before. And it dovetails into this. And that was, while I was in the middle of doing all of my research and during that period when I was, my position was evolving, the raid on the Branch Davidians took place, right?
Right.
That was something like, February of 93, maybe?
Yeah,
Somewhere in there, give or take. And so my reaction as a civil libertarian was, they instead of going and knocking on the door with a search warrant, the ATF shows up and makes a commando-style raid on American citizens. what the hell is going on here?
Religious freedom died too then.
Yeah. And the point that I made, I would argue with people about this, and I would say, look, here's something you have to know. For one thing, it's legal. Even today, it is legal for a person in the United States to have a machine gun. It's legal. You have to pay a $200 tax. There's a transfer tax. So you have to pay a $200 tax and fill out some paperwork. And you can have a full auto machine gun. And people say, what? I said, yeah, that's right. So all of this stuff you heard about child abuse and underage sex with children and all this stuff, well, although none of it was ever, it was alleged and never proved, and it had been investigated by the state, but you know what? It's irrelevant because the federal government doesn't have any authority in that.
Exactly.
No authority whatsoever. So this was all something that was thrown out to make the Davidians unsympathetic. This raid was over a failure to pay a $200 tax. Now, I'd be willing to bet that some people have had traffic tickets that are close to $200, depending upon the jurisdiction.
Right.
So how would you like to, let's say you make a wrong turn and now you're facing a 70 or 80 buck ticket, but you know, a SWAT team descends on you and manhandles you and throws you to the ground because of a traffic violation.
That's not the American way.
That's what this was. Worst case was that it was a failure to pay a $200 tax.
Wow. And I said back at the time, the Branch Davidians, they weren't robbing banks. They weren't hassling people. They weren't doing home invasions, carjacking. They were minding their own business. And they're surrounded by gun-owning Texans. You're not going to – Branch Davidian is going to get shot if he goes to somebody's house.
Well, yeah,
trouble.
Look, their ideas were kooky.
Sure,
granted, but like the late great Robert Heinlein once pointed out, one man's theology is another man's belly laugh. I mean, we all have odd beliefs, and in America, we tolerate them, and we tolerate them in this sense. That is, we don't have to associate with them. We shouldn't be made to associate with them. But toleration means you don't use the government against them.
Right.
This fundamentally was to use a tactic that goes back to the early days of drug prohibition or the beginnings of drug prohibition. It started with the Harrison Anti-Narcotics Act of 1914. Which was just to bring certain drugs, chiefly opiates and cocaine, under a prescription control through the taxing power. Unconstitutional, by the way, but let's lay that aside. It was the camel's nose. And
right.
Over the next 15 to 20 years, through a series of strategic prosecutions, the Treasury Department was able to increase the reach and scope of its power. So by the time that alcohol prohibition was coming to an end, drug prohibition was actually in place. So that process of using strategic prosecutions, and the strategic prosecutions would be, you single out somebody who is the perfect object. So maybe you have a doctor who is sort of on the raffish edge of society and maybe doing a little gray market business on the side.
Right.
So that's the guy you prosecute. And so over time, you create a body of case law that incrementally increases your power to finally push for prohibition. And the same thing was going on with guns.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the difference was that there was nobody was really fighting against drug prohibition all that much. There were some, but drug prohibition was tied in to racism in
Definitely.
Very significant ways. Although, so is gun prohibition, by the way.
Yeah. You know, I got some a couple of staunch conservatives I know, very pro-gun staunch conservatives, to begrudgingly, repeat, is it begrudgingly or grudgingly admit to me when I told them that, just like drugs, if guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. And do you have any doubt that the same crowd who provides illegal drugs will then move into the illegal gun market? Do you have any doubt that that would happen? And they grudgingly said, yeah, that would probably be the case.
Yeah, you know? And I think we've seen this ongoing scandal with Fast and Furious, the case of the walking guns, the euphemism.
We'll give you the guns. The feds will give you the guns.
You had a number of different factions, if you will, that were aligned. One is, of course, our good friends in the ATF. The ATF always wants to expand its power. All bureaucracies want to do that. You know, it's an imperative. It's a law of nature. So all bureaucracies, whether they're corporate or union or government, they all want to increase their power. Of course, the problem with government bureaucracies is they're backed up by the power of the state. And at least they would like a monopoly on the use of deadly force. They don't quite have that yet. But so you have the ATF, which is always interested in increasing its power. And so here's an opportunity to demonstrate to the public that there is this threat, and we need stronger laws, which will then the ATF can implement, right? So that's their interest. Then you have the Department of Justice, which I would say is maybe quasi-neutral in this area, but of course the Department of Justice wants to increase its power too. But the Department of Justice is heavily politicized by Holder and Obama appointments. So all you have to do is you just dangle in front of the bureaucrats, hey, we got more power for you, you know, there are more things that you can do. And meanwhile, the Obama administration had an agenda. They want to ban guns. I don't think there can be any doubt of that. So you have these different factions, the natural bureaucratic push in a certain direction, and then you have the Obama administration. And so you have these different entities all pushing in the same direction. And fortunately, or at least, you know, maybe it's more a matter of just this is the way it works. They were just grotesquely inept at it, and it's blown up in their face.
And, of course, we have to add the DEA in all this, too, and probably the FBI. You know, they all work together. It's all secretive,
yeah.
You know.
That's wrapped up in
patriotism.
That's right. Well, here's another thing, too. Can I digress a little bit?
Sure.
The method that was perfected in the push for drug prohibition, and then once drug prohibition was to increase the visibility of a bureaucracy, of an organization, and perhaps to gain more power. And this was also happening during alcohol prohibition, but it was really big with drug prohibition. And the thing is, the idea of having the sting and the informant, stings and informants, and along with that, you have entrapment.
Of course.
Well, one thing that's been going on is we keep having these terror cells. Every now and then, there's a terror cell, and you find there's all this flurry of news, and the usual folks will talk about how, oh, gee, we had these, these terrorists were getting ready to set off a bomb somewhere, and there's actually a real terrorist. So, you know, there was the guy who botched his bomb, the bomb he tried to set off in Times Square, and then there was some guy who fired at people coming in and out of Langley, what was it, CIA or something like that. So he had a AK or something like that, shooting people. You know, so there are some real ones. You know, and obviously the guy in Fort Hood. So you know, there probably been half a dozen of these people. But at the same time, you know, in other words, I don't want to minimize that these incidents do occur. But an awful lot of incidents are in the nature of trolling for people who may be sympathetic, but who would never do anything, who would never take action. And then you facilitate that, and you use that to get them to then commit an act, which you can then blow up into, oh, well, we found another terror cell. And that is, it's actually basically entrapping people.
Now, oh, yeah.
The idea of what constitutes entrapment has evolved over time. But for all intents and purposes, you take somebody who is a blowhard, and you facilitate their construction of explosives, which are, of course, fake explosives, and they're not even smart enough to figure out that what they have is not real. And then, of course, you get them to push the button, and then once they've done that, they've committed the act, and then you arrest them.
Well, that's what the FBI does that, and this they enable these people to entrap them. Like you said, people who normally otherwise wouldn't do this sort of thing, and it's more or less to justify their own existence. I saw something I thought was quite funny last year. I saw a libertarian fellow somewhere. I think he was talking to government bureaucrats, or I don't know. I forget what it was, but he goes, I like the old-fashioned terrorists that, they design their own bombs without any enabling help from the FBI or the authorities, and he got a lot of applause on that. I mean, obviously, I'm against terrorism, too, but I really resent the fact that the FBI, they try to, lead these people on, and then they, it gets big news, and then, of course, it helps to justify their budgets or making their budgets larger. Yeah. So it's awful.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that you and I agree on this, and that is that while there was a very big terrorist attack, it's very hard to put those together. And hell, the whole terrorist network's been largely disrupted. Their ability to do anything is very limited, and the extent to which we've been made to surrender our basic liberties in order to fight against a minuscule threat is really appalling. Look at it this way. As I say, I think there have probably been maybe a half dozen legitimate terrorist events since 9/11. We could probably tick them off. And yes, there have been people killed, but you have to look at it in the context of what are the overall societal threats. And in that context, we just have this huge, huge overreaction.
And, of course.
Of course, a surrender of freedom. I travel an awful lot for my job. And I hated it when it was just the metal detectors. I just really hated it, so you can imagine how much I hate it now.
Yeah.
And there's simply no reason for it. And oh, by the way, it's all unconstitutional anyway.
Yeah, but it's all wrapped up in patriotism, TSA.
Well, yeah, kind of. I think it. I mean, there's a certain aspect. I think of it gets down to the incremental cost for the individual is such relative to the inconvenience that they've actually done a fairly good job of backing off on some of the more onerous aspects See, everything they've done is they've tried to they've tried to pacify us so that we won't react in a big way. And of course, there is a justification because every now and then we have these stories of, you know, the inept underwear bomber and some of these other people. Fortunately, they were inept. But see, I mean, in a way, that's indicative of how effectively we've disrupted the terror network. I mean, we spent a lot of money to go out and take care of the Taliban and et cetera, and destroy terror networks. And so they don't really have much capability to do anything except, you know, onesies and twosies.
That's why for me the main
big raids are very, they can't really pull them off anymore.
My main enemy is the federal government
and
their raids.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
My main enemy is the federal government and their raids and all the things they do. I'm much more,
exactly.
I hate to say afraid, but, you know, they're listening right now, I'm sure. But, they're the problem. The feds are the problem. I mean, to give guns to all these, the Mexican drug lords. And I laugh whenever they say, well, they killed this drug lord, Mexican drug lord. He's been arrested. Their military grabbed him. Yeah, someone's just going to take his place in a few days. You know, it can't be one. They're just making it worse. I think there's what is it like 50,000 Mexicans or whatnot have died in the last 2 or 3 years now in this all this drug war down there.
That could certainly be. I'm not really up on the. I'm not up on
the numbers
data,
are high, Paul. The numbers
I'll take
are
your word
high.
For it. I'm sorry.
The numbers are high. They're almost like Vietnam GI numbers.
I can believe that. I can certainly believe that.
And this has been caused by the federal government, which has exported its drug war to the rest of the world. I mean, Colombians don't like it. Europeans don't like it. You know, I know you travel a lot. I've traveled out of the country a lot. When you have discussions with people out of the country, you see, you know, what they're talking about. They don't hate you or McDonald's. They don't like Uncle Sam. I don't either. And there have been the, you know, back to this whole drug thing, Uncle Sam's been behind this with the drug war and then, you know, incremental assaults on our gun rights. And so many guns obviously are involved in the drug war. There's so many killings and innocent people and children getting caught in the crossfire. And, you know,
yeah,
they
let's,
just
you had mentioned this before, and let's return to that. There was one of the pieces of research that I came across when I was doing my work with this commission was, although I certainly looked into the constitutional end of things, I also looked into the criminological end of things.
Right.
And a former president of the American Criminology Association, a fellow by the name of, I think his name is Alfred Blumstein. Yeah, I think that's his name. Anyway, when powdered cocaine gave way to crack, and crack all of a sudden became the big new street drug, because basically you could buy it in small amounts and you could smoke it, and it was convenient and so forth. And of course, well, then we had the crack epidemic, right? But crack was being used, so there was a crack fad, and then of course the law enforcement just went completely bonkers about it, and there was actually an increase in use of crack, but also there was a very brisk trade because it was so popular.
Right.
The combination of the black market, of course, naturally the way that since the drugs are illegal, it could only be a black market. But the trade in crack resulted, according to the research that Blumstein did, over about a 5-year period, there was an anomalous increase in homicides in the male age group 15 to 24. I believe it's that demographic.
Sounds about right.
I'm within a year plus or minus, so that's close enough for government work, if you will. And so what Blumstein did was he said, look, let's look at all of the factors that go into that are determinants of the crime rate. And so he eliminates every single one of them. What he comes up with at the end of this analysis is there are 18,000 more homicides than there should have been. And the only explanation for this is that it's tied in with the black market and crack. So this was a really nice piece of research done by Blumstein that supports exactly the point you were making, and that is that it's the black market that is an important driver of homicide rates. Now, what the overall percentage is, it's hard to say. Some estimates are 25%. The high end is maybe 50, and I think that's probably fair. Something between 50 and 25% of homicides in the United States are probably tied in with the black market trade in drugs. Because I mean, if you look at where the homicides are being committed and who is committing the homicides, you see that it's young males and they're in the inner city mostly.
Oh yes, it's been devastating.
So that's where you see it, and these are the guys who are involved in the drug trade. You know, it's not the drugs themselves making you go out and kill. I mean, for one thing, if you use heroin, you don't feel like doing anything. You know, heroin is a narcotic. It's a soporific. Well, maybe not a soporific, but it's certainly a narcotic, right? And cocaine is just kind of nicotine, super nicotine. And if you use nicotine in the kinds of concentrations people use cocaine, it would be comparable. In fact, I think high levels of nicotine are psychedelic.
Well, it's like I like to say, you know, the liquor store owners are not shooting it out with each other because it's legal, it's, you know, it's regulated.
Right.
We learned
from alcohol prohibition.
We did?
At least for alcohol. But the other drugs, they, for some reason, they don't apply. And I guess it's because they were not socially acceptable. So because they were always associated with, well, in the case of opiates, those were associated with the Chinese.
The drug laws were aimed at the Chinese, blacks, Latins, and also musicians. A lot of the drug wars and a lot of the marijuana laws. So,
I think the musicians were kind of, you know, collateral damage. Really.
It just compounded the problem.
There were plenty of black jazz musicians.
Right.
But,
right, and what I learned from reading Ron Paul, actually 23 years ago, I read his essay on the case for drug legalization, and he had said that, you know, illegal drugs, drug prohibition leads to harder drugs, where if you look in the legal market, you have less salt, no fat, low fat, low nicotine, but in the illegal market, it's harder drugs, and, you know,
yeah,
the more they prohibit...
Right.
They prohibit other drugs, and the other things come on the market. Other, you know,
right.
Like crystal meth and all this other junk. And
yeah,
again,
exactly
if all this
right.
stuff was, if it was all re-legalized for adults and sold in liquor stores or pharmacies, mm-hmm. most people are not going to go out. You and your wife aren't going to go out and shoot heroin. Grandpa and grandma aren't going to go out and do crystal meth. It just doesn't work that way. Yes, at first, some people would misuse it. They would die. They would learn their lesson, and others would see that, and hopefully they'd wake up. But we wouldn't have all this shooting and the crossfire and the crime and the theft and more encroachment on our gun rights due to the drug war.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a pattern that I laid out early on by which government accrues power. And that pattern was established with drug prohibition. It has been tried with guns, but there was a big reaction. And we got a couple of favorable Supreme Court decisions. Though it's worth noting that in those Supreme Court decisions don't necessarily set limits on what is considered acceptable regulation. And I warned about this back in the mid 90s, that what I said back then was that I felt that the case that the Second Amendment protected an individual right was so strong that the Supreme Court would have to conclude just that, that the Supreme Court would have to incorporate the Second Amendment as an individual right, but that it would be a right that could be regulated, and further, that all of the existing regulations would be deemed constitutional. Now, that hasn't happened yet. That hasn't happened yet. But I warned about that 15 years ago. And so that's something I think to be concerned about. See, I mean,
hey,
I'm sorry, go on.
Speaking of guns, I read an interesting article about a year or two ago by a fellow who was talking about guns and hunting and defense. And this fellow is an experienced gun owner and I think ex-military, and he swears – I'd like to hear your comments on this if you're familiar with this or you might agree. He swears by the 20-gauge shotgun. He says it's a great all-purpose weapon. It's a great hunting rifle, and it's great home protection. He was very praiseworthy of it, in particular, a 20-gauge shotgun. Would you know anything about that?
That could be.
You're more of a handgun person,
aren't
you?
My weapon of choice is a Glock 21. Well, there are two pistols that I carry. I have a Glock 21, which is a large frame 45 caliber, and then I have a Makarov, which is it fires the short 9mm, and it's a knockoff of the Valter PPK, the pistol that James Bond carried. There was a Russian knockoff of this Valter PPK, which is basically the police handgun, the auto, and then various of the Warsaw Pact countries would develop their own. And the one I have, I think it's a Bulgarian, unless it's an East German. I can't remember.
So you're usually carrying? Well, you can carry concealed when you're out and about.
I usually carry concealed. One thing you didn't ask me about was my open carry program.
Yeah, you know, I forgot to mention, I read your and I enjoyed your Why I Carry essays. And I'm winding down a little bit now. What was your go ahead about that? What you just mentioned.
Yeah, well, the idea with open carry was the law doesn't really make a distinction in Indiana. Some states did make a distinction or do make a distinction. There were many states where you could carry openly, but you couldn't carry concealed. But people tended not to do that, and law enforcement would also hassle you, because they didn't seem to know their own laws. And so my feeling in 2000 was that we were very close to losing our rights, and with the 2000 election coming and the possibility of Gore winning, which is very troubling.
How does the future look for gun ownership?
Standpoint. Pardon?
How does the future look for gun ownership, gun rights?
Maybe better. We'll have to see. But anyway, I decided that what I should do is I should do what the homosexual community had done with such great success, and that was to come out of the closet.
Speak for yourself.
So I figure, okay, I'll start carrying openly, and in doing so, I'm just letting people know that I've been around you for the past 6 years or so, and every time you've seen me, I've had a gun.
I'm comfortable around people.
It didn't bother you before, and I'm the same person, so I'll just wear the gun. And I did a bunch of press releases, so I wanted to make sure everybody knew what I was doing. And so I had press releases in the Indy Star and in the local newspaper, and the idea was to kind of generate some discussion and maybe drive people to my website. And I did it for a period of about 9 months.
Well, I feel safer around people that do have guns, because I know that if in an altercation, they're going to shoot the bad guy. So I'm not worried about them. And the NRA members are not carjacking and breaking in homes or robbing banks. You know, they're the responsible gun owners. However, whenever I go by a NRA booth, which I did recently at a Republican conservative caucus, I'll always go up to them and say, "Hey, I'm a very proud gun owner." "Oh, are you an NRA member?" "No, because I will never join the NRA as long as they support the drug war." And then they usually hem and haw, and I smile and walk away. But, you know, I won't be part of that because they're shooting themselves, pun intended, in both feet.
Yeah. Yeah. I was a member of the NRA for a while, and I quit. I sent them a letter quitting. And actually, there were several reasons why I quit, but I felt as though they were far too establishment. I think there was a speech that was given under the auspices of the NRA about that was slamming homosexuals, and I thought it was gratuitous. And I thought, this is just reactionary bullshit.
Yeah.
So I basically sent him a letter, and I said, you know what? I don't want to have anything to do with you folks. For a while, I was involved with gun owners, but I was more heavily involved with a group called Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. It's a very good
group. That was a small membership.
Pardon? Probably so. But they did some very interesting work. There was one book that they put out called Lethal Laws, and their thesis, which is an interesting thesis, is that gun restrictions preceded genocides. So there was a Nazi law that preceded the attempts to exterminate, nearly successful attempts to exterminate the Jews in Europe. And the Turks did something similar with the Armenians. So there were restrictive gun laws in Turkey, and then they went after the Armenians. And so they asserted a pattern. Now, to what extent is that actually true? I mean, for example, in the case of Jews in Europe, well, culturally, Jews just really tended not to carry guns. So the law wasn't necessary to disarm Jews. They had self-disarmed.
Right.
I can't speak for the situation for the Armenians, but getting back to the point, certainly if the government places very severe controls on the ability of people to arm themselves, then you can end up with the kind of situation that you have in Iran, where you had a popular movement to resist the corruption in the governmental elections. And that didn't go very far. They filled the streets for a while, but eventually the authorities began, you know, backed up by guns, put an end to it. And, although in the Middle East there have been some successes, in every case it was because the military, a sizable fraction of the military, decided to side with the demonstrators. So that was very key, that there was a faction of the military that got involved. But otherwise, you know, if you're just sufficiently ruthless and willing to shoot some people, that's the end of it.
Well, thanks for not shooting at me today, Paul. Just joking. I certainly appreciate having you back on, and I certainly appreciate you carrying the banner for, you know, not only the First Amendment, of course, which is pretty damn easy to defend usually, but the Second Amendment. So I appreciate you doing what you're doing and being an activist and being, you know, essays, whatever you do, whatever you write, that's always a good thing. So I'm going to close down now. Wish you a happy Halloween. Take care. Great. Thank you very much. This is your host, PK, signing off now. I'm here for a Third Stream View every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Eastern, and 11:55 sorry, 11:55 Eastern, 10:55 Central. So until next time, this is your humble host, PK, saying goodnight, everyone.